This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to I'm Absolutely Fine, the podcast from The Midult that looks at all the glamour and indignity of being a grown-up.
Hello everyone, I'm Annabelle and I'm absolutely fine, but yesterday I had a full day of meetings, one of those sort of 8 till 6, bang, 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 and I decided to put some armour on my face. And for the first time in ages during the day, I wore eye makeup. I'll usually stick on a bit of tinted moisturiser and bronzer just because the alternative is sickly Victorian child, as previously discussed, sickly decrepit Victorian child. But yesterday I did liquid eyeliner and mascara. That's all, you know, quite lo-fi. And the reaction was people practically, it was like the parting of the Red Sea. They almost fell to the floor with astonishment. Oh my God, oh my God, you look amazing. And it was really insulting. So I was like, how awful do I usually look? I mean, quite awful, but that awful? So now do I need to wear liquid eyeliner and mascara every day? Do I, Emily?
I don't know, you're asking the wrong person because I have decided completely to stop. Because I don't think that any, well, my skill set is not able to fix my face in any way with makeup. So better to go barefaced horror.
Well, it's not your skills. I think it's your face. As in, your face doesn't like makeup much, does it?
It doesn't. It doesn't like makeup.
It tries to throw it off in the opposite direction.
Yes, exactly. Well, it just doesn't seem to, yes, exactly, have any impact whatsoever. Anyway, I'm Emily and I'm absolutely fine. And I pissed myself on the way back from Pilates, which I have to tell you, okay, may sound like the most humiliating thing ever, but I was so excited to be able to text you that text.
It was the best text ever.
It just
ever.
Shows how one has become so kind of used to accidents, she says, in a kind of terrible, like, that actually it was the joke that was great. I was like, brilliant. I can't wait to tell Annabelle.
Yes, yes. The upside outweighed the downside. And did you find that rather than going, oh no, this is a disaster, what's happening to me on my pelvic floor? You just thought, oh, for fuck's sake, never mind.
Basically, yeah, exactly. Oh, for fuck's sake, never mind. And I feel like, yeah, this is where we live now. Hooray. Anyway, okay, guys, let's not talk about my pelvic floor. Let's talk about sex. So we've roped in a psychosexual therapist, and not just any psychosexual therapist. Kate Moyle is also the host of the Sexual Wellness Sessions podcast, and she's written a book called The Science of Sex, Every Question About Your Sex Life Answered. So let's get down to it, Kate. But first, we should probably ask, how are you?
I'm absolutely fine, but my to-do list is causing me more stress than it is doing good currently. It is growing exponentially at a rate I can't keep up with, and I'm now in full denial mode.
To-do lists have babies. To-do lists have horrible mutant babies, and you can't, they're like gremlins at nighttime. Or was it gremlins at night, or was it gremlins when they came into contact with water? Anyway, the bad kind, not the cuddly kind.
You can't feed gremlins at night. Or get them wet. Surely that's not ingrained on your soul.
I don't know why I've gone the kind of gremlin route. But to-do lists are very unrelaxing things. They're meant to solve problems. And I don't know what the alternative is, though, because our memories are clearly not to be relied upon.
No, absolutely not. And as you say, there's the home, there's the work, there's the house, the life admin, that just they collectively seem to be growing in all sorts of directions that I can't keep up with.
I think the depressing thing about a to-do list is the to-do list is never done.
Yeah.
You want to just be able to put a line through everything, but that never happens. And so it's very demoralising, you know, just in essence, isn't it?
Totally. I think you've hit the nail on the head there.
I think a lot of people have sex on their to-do list and not in a happy way. I mean, maybe we should start by talking a little bit about actually how you got into talking about sex, helping people with their sex lives, and generally having a life that semi-revolves around sex.
Yeah, I also, the sex on the to-do list thing, tick box sex and should sex are, just such a big part of that. We'll definitely come back to that. I have been doing this for 10 years, and my initial training was in psychosexual therapy and then relationship therapy. And I kind of work with a blend of the two, but with my specialism being working with people struggling with sexual problems. And really, it came out of quite an academic interest, which was I was fascinated by psychology. I always knew, even since I was kind of a child, I would do some kind of job that involved talking to people. And as that progressed through adulthood and the training I was doing, I just realized that it was so fascinating that this was the one part of our lives that we kind of kept under lock and key. But when you start talking to people about it, or you start kind of investigating, or someone says something, that there's this little shift in body language. There's a slight shift in energy, and there apparent, you know, there appear to be lots of people struggling, but not very many people talking about the fact they're struggling. And as soon as I then kind of moved into that specialism, it was like the floodgates just opened, and it was everywhere, and it was kind of happening in so many conversations, but they're not happening at the same time. And it started really as early as my kind of university dissertation, which I was studying evolutionary psychology modules, and we did a study based around that. And I was like, isn't this interesting that even, you know, in people who are kind of 20, 21, that these conversations, who are kind of arguably having the most free sex of their lives at university, are still finding this a bit odd. And I think that kind of planted the seed in quite a big way.
Mm. It's funny, that thing, the idea that one's having the freest sex of their lives at 21. In my personal experience, and anecdotally, I'm not sure that's true. I think that perhaps that's the narrative we're sold. But in fact, that might be the worst, most tense and most pressurized sex that we ever have.
Totally.
Because there seems to be something to prove as a free young person, you know, with sex as our oyster, as it were.
I think it's the perfect example of how expectations and, you know, I think that's when I said, like, supposedly, because I think also what we see is people in long-term relationships often report the best quality of sex. But it's such a perfect example of how expectations of sex, whatever they look like, can create lots of sexual dilemmas and sexual challenges and sexual problems where they wouldn't necessarily exist otherwise.
And as you're saying, it's hard to know who to talk to about it, because I don't think people think that their GP is going to help unless it's a solely physical problem. Do you talk to your friends? Is that gossip? Is it helpful? You know, you might be in very different personal circumstances to them. And I think it's been written about quite unhelpfully, perhaps, for years in newspapers and magazines. So we sort of think that the advice is always going to be to tickle each other with a feather or lie next to or stare into each other's eyes, or stuff that we find might not be attractive, accessible, or anything other than sort of funny to us. So it's hard to know where to go for really good, nutritious, effective, practical advice. So that's why it's so good to talk to you.
And on top of it as well, I think that, you know, that sex, or the idea of sex, or good sex, or sexual tension, is the backdrop of basically all our lives. It's used to sell everything that we, you know, look at this car, it's so sexy, it might make you sexier, look at the lines, or, you know, from everything. So the idea of having a problem or finding sex uncomfortable, difficult, awkward, makes you feel like you are kind of out of that conversation. And that shame obviously is what stops people from talking about it. And then obviously, as you said, creates more and more problems. So where do people start? What do they say to you?
Yes, what do you hear most often?
Well, the line that lots of people say is, I've never said this to anyone before, is quite a big start. I always say, as a psychosexual therapist, I'm pretty used to the fact that people don't want to be there, that people, I'm one of the last people would actually like to come and talk to or like to come and see, because often it's treated as a last resort. And that's changing, and that has definitely changed in the years that I've been practicing. It feels like people are starting to, probably with the general trend for therapy becoming more talked about and more normalized, tackle problems earlier than leaving it until they get to rock bottom and then sorting it out. But something I feel is apparent is that anxiety about sex is the kind of undercurrent to most, if not all, sexual difficulties in some way, shape or form. Now, whether that is that someone is having cancer treatment and it's completely changed their sex life, or they've had an injury, or they're struggling with desire. I work with a lot of people with sexual dysfunctions, couples who are struggling, people who might have been going through infertility, whether it's menopause, whether it's infidelity, difficulties communicating about sex, kind of the list really just goes on and on and on. But the kind of premise is that sex has become something that provokes anxiety or provokes fear. And the relationship with sex has changed in some way, and people don't quite know how to change it into something different. And I say that because often people want to go back. They say, I want us to go back to how we used to be, or I want it to be like it used to, you know, like it was. And something I'm often kind of challenging with people is, okay, but why can't we get it to somewhere different, which isn't back? Because nothing else is going to go back. We have to adapt and look at what it's going to be or what we'd like it to be next.
Mm. Which is quite scary because it's the unknown, isn't it?
Mm.
People just think, why can't we be doing it the way we were doing it in the first 6 months we met, when you've been together for 15 years with three kids, a mortgage and a, you know, God knows what else.
And we really glamorize this idea of the honeymoon period. And yeah. When you think about the honeymoon period, it often, most often, is absent of all of the things you just described, of all of the responsibilities, yeah. of the things you need to think about, the negotiations, the compromises. You're throwing yourself in head first, and then at some point you kind of come up for air.
Yeah, literally. And it's the kind of thing, isn't it, where that early sex, a lot of the thrill is the newness. And there's no reason why sex that happens later can't be better in a different way.
Totally. We know that desire thrives on novelty, that our brains are designed to love newness, love exploration, love curiosity, that, you know, we have neurochemical releases, you know, like dopamine release, mm-hmm. which encourages that, you know, rewards us for trying new things. And then that we also habituate to everything in life as humans. We get used to things. When things become predictable, we get into routines. That's how we need that mm-hmm. to live our lives. We can't constantly be in this kind of really high, exciting exploration phase. Mm-hmm. But sex is no different. The same things happen in our sex life as they do everything else.
Mm. A friend of mine said to me the other day, happily married, loves her husband. She said, we've had sex once in the last year and we were drunk, and now it just feels embarrassing. So how do you find your way back from just no longer feeling that you're in that place with a person and you feel slightly ashamed about it, but unwilling to directly put it on the table? How does one start to have that conversation with someone that you love?
Yeah, the talking about sex part is probably the hardest bit of our sex lives, the biggest challenge that we come up against. And something I say a lot is, the irony is, the person who's hardest to talk to about sex is the person I'm having sex with. And really, I'd be interested to know with that person, what was different when they were drunk? Was it just that they felt less inhibited, they felt more brave, that they kind of took a chance, whereas normally they might worry about being rejected, or they're worrying that their partner's gonna kind of react in a different way? There was something that gave them permission when they'd had a few drinks to act in a different way for both of them, for both parties in this instance. And I'd want to know what that is, because then you can start to harness that. But I think the difficult thing is to start the conversation, which is the thing that most of us don't want to do, is to say something like, you know, I had a great time the other night. Maybe we should try and do that again. You know, it feels a bit awkward for us talking back. I think acknowledging the awkwardness sometimes. And particularly this is relevant for couples that have been together a really long time and have just never really talked about sex. And I think that we assume that this has to be people that haven't been having sex for years that struggle with this. This is across the board. And I think that sometimes leaning into that and using that kind of recent occasion as a reminder and saying, like, I had a lot of fun, or did you, like, I really enjoyed that. Maybe we should try it again sometime. And kind of also trying to build those bridges back in. Often not having sex feels like a problem for us, and then the amount of time we haven't had sex for becomes a secondary but often even bigger problem. We hold that to take a lot of meaning.
This is an advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online.
Okay, serious question. How many times have you been out recently? Actually, you know, scratch that. How many times have you woken up the day you were supposed to go out and felt flooded with dread? How long have you spent praying that the other person will cancel so you don't have to?
And yet, just as we're avoiding people, so many of us feel really lonely and more tired than ever, particularly now the days are getting a bit longer and you think, how am I going to have the energy to go out into the world?
Our social batteries are very flat at the moment, and that can make us feel isolated, which can lead to trouble. And in my experience, therapy has helped me track my best energy sources and helped me better identify what leaves me feeling depleted.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, why not give BetterHelp a try?
It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist and switch anytime for no additional charge.
With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise.
Listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp
betterhelp.com/midult. That's better, HELP.com/midult.
BetterHelp, because sometimes the best thing to do is acknowledge that we are not, in fact, absolutely fine. Yes, I like the idea of giving yourself permission. A lot of this, isn't it, is about giving yourself permission sexually to be someone you haven't always been, to, you know, just to change and evolve the way that we expect to do in many other areas of our life, and for that to be okay and healthy and encouraged.
I thought it was interesting in your book when you talked about in long-term relationships specifically that often affection or any kind of physical affection is non-existent unless it's a sort of gateway to the sexual journey. So it's sort of like, so there's no kind of casual intimacy or contact that isn't so. And actually, if it was sort of more normalized to sit on the sofa and kind of, you know, hug or whatever, then maybe, you know, all of these things kind of create incremental pathways to a kind of like a closeness that doesn't necessarily have to end up in sex, but doesn't mean that the barrier to sex is closed. Does that make sense?
Definitely. And one of the things that we see is really common when couples are struggling with sex is they stop doing all of those things. Because what you do is you cut out the middleman. Because say if sex is associated with whether it's failure or anxiety or fear, or we'd rather avoid it, what we do is we cut out anything that might lead to sex. So cuddling in bed, being naked together, as you said, kissing on the sofa, or like jumping in the shower, whatever it is, the little things that previously would have potentially led to sex, we stop doing because we don't want to start something that we feel like we can't say to our partner, actually, I'm feeling too stressed about sex, or I don't want to have sex, or so we don't want to lead them on or start an expectation of something. So we cut that stuff out, and that's something we refer to as sexual currency. And then we're not just missing sex, but we're missing all of the physical intimacy, the little moments, that connection. And that often becomes a problem for couples. And something we hear a lot in couples therapy, psychosexual therapy, is, and I honestly, like the exact lines I've heard them so many times, is you only touch me or approach me when you want to have sex. And the other person says, if I didn't do that, it would never happen. And it's a habit and a pattern that gets very, very ingrained. And couples have to consciously and intentionally change it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how do you feel about the idea of, you talk about tick box sex, should sex, maintenance sex. Do you think it's important in a long relationship to make sure that you have a certain amount of sex, whether you really want to or not?
What's difficult about that as a question is the certain amount of sex for some couples could be twice a year, for other couples could be once a month. And what that revolves around is what sex means to you, or how important sex is to you in your relationship. And we know that people who are asexual have romantic couple relationships and are really happy, and sex is not a part of their lives at all. What is important is the navigating the difference between partners. And for lots of people, sex is associated with a level of relationship satisfaction or a level of intimacy or feeling like they're desired or feeling close to their partners. And if that's the case and it happening regularly, then yes, it is very important for you. But we also know that couples, for example, where one person might be having, let's say like chemotherapy, for example, and might be feeling absolutely awful, kind of completely on their knees, and also not recommended to have sex for a period of time because of the type of medication they're on, or that they can still have the intimacy and they can still have the moments that give them almost all of the other feelings and the benefits.
Yeah, because it is possible in relationships, isn't it, to have sort of a sex drought for even for years and to find your way back. I think people start to feel hopeless, but I'm not sure that they should.
Absolutely. And droughts are something that often come from the fact that both parties are kind of waiting for the other one to start something, or waiting for the other one to shift something, or waiting for the other one to do something. And we end up waiting a really long time. And then the longer it's gone on for, the more we read into that. And it takes bravery. It takes a bit of putting yourself out there. It takes the initiation. We talk about intentionally making this a part of your lives. And it's not the Disney version, which is that relationships and sex don't take work. Nothing in life doesn't take work. But we seem to think that this part of our lives have this magical kind of self-maintenance, I don't know, mechanism. And we all know that not to be true. And we know from the statistics that it's also not true.
Yeah. Speaking of bravery, how would you, let's say that one half of a couple wants to spice things up and wants to look into kink or just stuff that they have never done, however colourful that may be, but is nervous. How would you suggest initiating that conversation rather than just whacking out a pair of handcuffs on a Friday night and ambushing someone?
Ambushing someone is never the best way to do it, because also your partner has to consent to enjoying or trying those things. But you're a step ahead. If you've been exploring it in your head on your own, to then kind of land it on them, they're going to be completely caught off guard, and that's not the best way to start something. I mean, really starting the conversation around, you know, I heard about this, or I listened to this, or I saw this in a Netflix episode, or what did you think of that scene on whatever show it was? Using those things as a starter and then leaning into that, oh, would you be interested in trying that? I think it sounds quite fun. And if your partner says no, try not to take it as a complete rejection of you, which is what a lot of people do. But then they're saying no to the act, not you as the person. And then you can say, okay, well, if you're not interested in that, is there anything you would be interested in? And there are all, you know, a lot of the elements of things like kink are about things like power exchange. And you can do that in lots of different ways. And so there might be something that you do feel settled on trying together, and that will give you a chance to do it in a more gentle way.
So let's say one person says, I would like to tie you up and blindfold you. What would be a beginner's version of that if that feels too scary?
Well, you could even use something like a kind of eye mask for when you're kissing or when you're in bed together. It could be something like, again, like making sure it's all within the frame of consent, like kind of holding your partner's hands while you're kissing or while you're having sex or making out. Or there are little ways that you can do that. Kind of playing with lighting in a room is another thing. But one of the things that's really good about playing with something like an eye mask rather than, and I think sometimes it being an item that's already in your home can feel a bit less intimidating, something that you know, might wear rather than you're going out and buying it.
Yes, exactly. I've been to Ann Summers and this is what I've got, or Coco de Mer or whatever. Here are
I've
all
I've been
my...
to the hardware store. Here's the duct tape and the rope.
Let's go. This is my list of fantasies. But I can imagine that you're right in terms of, you know, the person who's suggesting it is already quite far down the line.
They've played
fantasy,
it out
presumably.
In their heads. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So the other person needs a period of adjustment. Also, because I think a lot of people worry about performance, don't they? And things like that. So the idea that, oh, well, what am I, is it, are you not satisfied? And then roll, you know, cue a whole bunch of anxieties. But actually, yes, to frame it in a way of saying, did you think that looked hot? I found that a bit hot. Maybe we could, you know, think about doing something. You can see how that might sort of start a very slow conversation.
And I would imagine that text messages are quite useful with this. You know, you don't necessarily have to be sitting there eyeball to eyeball, take a deep breath. You could maybe compose a thought and say, what do you think? Or I was thinking, or maybe, or, you know, and put it down that way. Weren't you texting Chris, your husband, at one point, Emily, and having a text argument? You were able to compose your thoughts much better and it was very successful.
Yes, we were sitting next to each other.
Well, okay. Well, this could happen sitting next to each other.
But it was very...
But, you know, there's more than one way to communicate, isn't there, Kate?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, Esther Perel talks about that. So she's a kind of world thought leader on sex and relationships. And she talks about that and kind of... Or setting up, for example, like an account that's just for you and your partner to email each other from. And she talks about it as also as cultivating a secret garden. But yes, if you find that easier, or you could send your partner a link to something and say, hey, what do you think about this?
Or imagining all number of things coming up on their phones in the middle of a meeting.
But, you know, think about why so many of us have awkward conversations in the car. It's because we're not facing each other. And it's the kind of venue, I suppose, of so many big conversations because people struggle more to have them face to face. And if you're starting to talk about something, you could always do it kind of on your Sunday morning walk with a coffee and be like, well, do you know what? I really enjoyed that episode of this on Netflix. Like, what do you think? Or, and it, I think be open to your partner's response, whatever that is. And like you said, Emily, the defensive response, which I think is often the thing that we also see played out on screen and in films and et cetera, is, okay, that's because I'm not good enough. Instead, we can treat it as, this is something I'd like to try with you. And those two things are very yes. different perspectives, but we are given the message a lot of the time that if it's because someone wants more, it's because we're not enough.
Mm. This word vanilla is bandied around a lot at the moment. Mm. So vanilla. And I think we also have to find a way to be just, you know, what does vanilla mean? And it's, you know, vanilla is very delicious.
Exactly. I was about to say that. A colleague of mine says that. They're like, vanilla is my favorite flavor. It's absolutely delicious. What's wrong with that? But also, one person's vanilla is another person's kink. You know, this is completely yeah. subjective. There's a complete spectrum of things going on here. And, you know, does it really matter? You know, why do we need to judge what someone's version of that is?
Well, in a way, talking about sex has become, is obviously very helpful, but when it's done unhelpfully, it can make us feel that sex is like an aptitude test crossed with general knowledge / gymnastics, you know, rather just an expression of intimacy and connection. So there's a lot of, as Emily says, because it sells everything, it's everywhere, it's coming at us a lot. So it's hard to know where we and our genuine desires fit in within all the volume.
Yes, I think that's true. And I also think that back to your vanilla point, Annabelle and I are always railing about the criticism of things being readable as being kind of slightly boring.
Or shoes being comfortable. Yeah,
exactly. But actually, you know, if you're having perfectly satisfying sex, you shouldn't feel any kind of pressure because of the idea that everybody else in the media is having explosive,
yeah.
mind-bending sex with fair, you know, I'm reading these romanticy books and, you know, obviously if you're not having sex with an archangel with an enormous penis, you know, why you're failing at life. But obviously that's just not true. Sorry, to my husband, who's obviously an archangel.
With an enormous penis.
but also it's the version of sex that we're shown all the time is curated, perfect, with, you know, perfect people with perfect bodies where everything just happens and works beautifully and functions without problem. And the versions of sex we're seeing are not representative, but they are the versions that we all can find, you know, literally type into Google and sex is instantly available. And therefore, that's what we compare ourselves against and the versions that people share. And they tend to be, you know, one end of the scale or the other. And particularly, you know, obviously in my world, you know, you're seeing people who are really struggling with sex, but in general society, it's all the, you know, really great, really beautiful, amazing, mind-blowing, perfect sex. And we're all sitting at home on the sofa watching it thinking, oh God, it's nothing. It looks absolutely nothing like what I'm doing at home. And it's interesting that where intimacy coordinators are playing an increasing role on set, that we're seeing these slightly more kind of realistic versions of sex happening. And Eta O'Brien, who's an amazing intimacy coordinator who I interviewed on my podcast, was saying things like she was going onto set and the scenes were set to be in positions which wouldn't physically be possible. And so then people are going home thinking, okay, we could try that, or maybe I could try that, or I could never do that. And she was like, it's not possible. You have to change the angling to make it, the body parts actually fit where they're meant to. And no wonder people are failing if we're not doing that part of it right.
It's funny that occasionally you do see a sex scene on telly or in a film and you think, I don't understand.
Mm.
I don't, I'm going to go with it, I suppose. But I
How
don't
are they
understand.
Doing that?
Yeah. What's happening?
And also, you know, I was about to say, when one attempts anything that is sort of like a bit more creative, maybe, and then
look like you're trying to get on all fours, Em. You feel like you're, what are you trying to do?
Sorry, just a cramp. Which is also cramp. Something that happens during sex.
It does happen during sex. So, and then there's the kind of dilemma that happens when you're single, you want to have sex, you're no longer 25, you haven't had sex with a new person for a long time, you probably aren't drinking as much as you were the last time you were perhaps having sex with new people, and you are terrified. Maybe you've had a baby, maybe your body's a bit battle-scarred, maybe your heart's a bit battle-scarred, and the desire is there, but you really feel genuinely frightened about being found wanting or any number of things. How to talk to yourself about that? How to approach that?
I think it's really, really common, and we're particularly seeing, you know, people kind of expressing that as they're coming out of divorces and starting their romantic life or their dating lives again, or people that have been widowed. And there's this real sense of, you know, we'd got comfortable with someone and then we have to kind of go back again. I think we always compare ourselves to the younger version of ourselves in those kind of scenarios. And I think the first thing to say is the person that you're dating or the potential partner probably has similar kind of feelings going on. You're probably not the only one struggling with that stuff. To take your time is the other thing. And I think sometimes you can acknowledge to someone that you're dating. You might say, do you know what, I feel a bit nervous about kind of doing this again or starting a sexual relationship again. And I think that there can be something in that, you know, give yourself a chance to take your time. Build a sexual relationship with yourself. It's something that, you know, a lot of people kind of park for a while. Particularly we see, you know, mothers saying that I've just not even really had much time or space to think about myself or prioritize myself for a long time. And that might be about kind of rediscovering your body, starting to build like a more sensual relationship with your body. It's not just about masturbation and solo sex, but about working out what makes you feel good in your body. So whether it's something really simple, like, you know, buying a moisturizer that you love the scent of and the feel of, and starting to actually take care of your body in a way that makes you feel good, isn't about how it looks, but is about how it feels. And these are little things. And I think getting back in touch with yourself sexually can also give you more confidence for when you go into that situation with someone new. And I think that's an important thing at any age, because so many of us can have, you know, bad breakups or have had relationships where we didn't feel good about ourselves, and we kind of carry that with us like a backpack into our next scenarios.
And often, I think particularly with women, maybe women in their, you know, 40s, 50s, I don't know, because I'm no longer 20. But I think that we have spent many years worrying about being desired and worrying less about what we want. So I assume that probably you could just take the time to have a really nice, like, you know, luxurious think about what might be fun.
Totally.
You know, we're always told that the brain is a sexual organ, which is always quite an intimidating phrase. But I suppose that's just literally sort of a bit of daydreaming, isn't it?
Well, it's also about remembering that we live in a society which sets up standards, particularly when it comes to female bodies, female beauty, female appearance, which completely pedestals youth. And so there is this it's quite unconscious, and it's very, very ingrained belief system, which is, you know, it's all about kind of being pretty and fresh and youthful. And that as soon as we start to move away from that, we become less valuable. And it's a really important thing for us to recognize that is happening kind of as the overarching kind of theme. And we have to kind of push back against that. And I think we're really, you know, the beauty standards are being pushed. It's something that is definitely happening. We've also seen a massive rise of the body positivity movement with the kind of rise of things like social media. But we are always comparing ourselves to an unrealistic, for the majority of people, standard. And catching yourself doing that is quite a useful thing. And I would recommend as well listening to things like podcasts or TED Talks or whatever it is about women feeling the same way, because there's such important messaging in recognizing or hearing yourself or your thoughts, which you might feel are your kind of, you know, whether it's like darkest or worst or biggest fears being voiced by someone else. There is something so relieving and confirming in that.
And no, you're not alone. Funny, sex can make you feel very alone.
It's interesting. No. It's interesting, exactly. And because one can feel so in one's head about all of this stuff. No, I was thinking as well, exactly in terms of the body positivity thing, you know, to look at other women, but not in a critical way, but just to see that, you know, there is this beauty standard, like sort of big billboard beauty standard, but actually we're all so different. One of the most useful, and I've said this on the podcast before, exercises I ever did was take my daughter to the ladies' park tampons on a hot day and the queue of, you know, 50, 60, 70 women for the pond and every single body shape available, every combination of long leg, short legged, you know, big boob, small boob, whatever. And it just reminds you that there is this, we have this idea, oh, everybody else is sort of perfect, but actually, no, we're all beautifully imperfect. And that's what's so amazing. And that actually the perfection that is just artificial, it's not real, and that we should try it's so hard, I know, not to beat oneself up over the head with it, but still
it'd be so boring if we're all the same.
But we do use sex as a way to beat ourselves up, don't we?
Yes,
it's a shame. It's like what you were saying earlier on the podcast, Kate, about anxiety. I remember reading a quote years ago that stayed with me, and it said everything in life is about sex, but sex is always about something else. It isn't just what it is it? It needs to integrate. We need to find a way to not make it a sort of sparkly, shiny, exotic thing that is so far away from the rest of our lives. It has to somehow self-sustain.
Totally. And it's something that we, for years, have kind of separated off as a different part of our lives. And one of the big things that I talk about is sexual wellness, and particularly kind of sex in terms of mental health and our relationship with self. And we've always portioned it off as this kind of separate thing. And you know, we've seen, interestingly, kind of in our culture as well, we're seeing an integration of sex in a big way. So, for example, now you can go to Boots and buy a vibrator.
John Lewis last week.
Yes. And it's all very visible. And that's an integration of it into our lives in that more normalizing way, which is, you know, we sell these products here and that's, you know, that's great. So it's not just this thing that's kind of portioned off to, you know, particular shops or like back streets anymore. And I think in terms of our own relationships with our sexuality, and what I mean with that is kind of sexual wellness is this kind of the role that sex plays in our lives and the relationships we have with it, is that it means so much. It's as much psychological, if not more, than it is physical. But always the conversation has based around the fact that it's something that we do. We've massively reduced, you know, everything from education to discussions to, you know, the versions of sex that we see to that this is just something that we do, but it's actually something that is a big part of us and something about kind of how we feel.
Can I just ask you something specific? Because you were talking earlier about lube on the shelf at Boots, and you know, it's on the grocery delivery, it's everywhere. And I think that certainly for a generation of women in their 40s and 50s, lube was not part of the conversation.
No.
And in fact, it was an indication of failure.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm not turned on enough. Whereas now the narrative is it just makes everything more fun. So how to bring that in for fun, not because there's a problem, when it's never been brought in before. How would you suggest one does that?
I love the point you just made. We have always associated historically the discussion around using lube as there's a problem, so we have to add something in. It is the most cost-effective and easy way of creating a change in your sex life. And I talk about it all the time. I highly recommend a brand called Yes Organics, which is all organic, all natural, and is brilliant. It's the perfect way of also breaking up routine.
Mm.
And it's great for other types of, you know, for kind of non-penetrative sex as well. It's great for things like mutual masturbation. You know, the vagina self-lubricates, the clitoris does not. And it's great for adding sensation. And the reality is, if you try something with a partner and you both have a great time and you both enjoy it, that's the best indicator of the fact that it's potentially going to happen again.
Mm. Can I ask you something? If people are really struggling with their sex lives and sort of haven't talked about it, don't know where to turn, think they might have, you know, an insurmountable problem, how effective do you think talking sex therapy can be? Would you recommend it? Would you encourage people who are scared to just give it a go?
Yes, but I'm obviously horribly biased.
But I almost want to say sort of how and why, just, you know, to encourage people to just have the conversation with a professional.
I think if you're looking for a psychosexual therapist, the first thing to say is in the UK, there's an organisation called the College of Sexual and Relationship Therapists. They have a directory of every registered and qualified psychosexual therapist in the country. So that would be the first place to go, because I think people don't know where to start. What it offers is an open, kind of non-judgmental space to have the difficult conversations you feel like you can't have on your own if you're going as a couple, or that you're too afraid if you have them on your own as a couple that it's going to blow up everything else. And I think the fear of rocking the boat or upsetting the status quo is often a reason that people don't go. And that person can help you a bit like a mediator navigate those conversations, offer advice. It gives you permission, something you mentioned earlier, to start to talk about it more, to try something new, to try something different. And it's quite a solution-focused model of therapy. But we also approach it from what we call biopsychosocial, so the biological side, the psychological side, and the social side. And it's quite integrative in terms of that. But I think that in general, psychosexual therapists are modeling like being comfortable talking about sex in a way which is quite good practice as well. But yes. You know, I describe my job quite like creative problem solving. And that's how I feel I work. Obviously, lots of therapists will kind of do it in different ways. But if you go and the first session doesn't feel like the right fit or doesn't feel like the right therapist, I would encourage people not just to give up, but to try a different therapist or say, you know, kind of send a few people inquiry emails, ask them if they'll do something like a 10-minute or 15-minute introductory call so you can get a feel for them before booking a session. Lots of therapists offer that.
Yeah, because I think obviously because it's an intimate problem again, and it gets people then worry about sharing it with, I mean, if they can't share it with their partner, then how will they share it with a stranger? But obviously somehow, yes, just giving people permission to talk about things would actually just make it so much easier for them to then be able to take, you know, talk about it amongst themselves.
Yeah, because it's a muscle, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the function of the relationship is that it is for you to be there to talk about that thing, and that person is completely removed from the rest of your life. So it kind of allows you to express all of that within that contained environment. And you know that you're not going to turn up for dinner and they're going to be there, that you know that you're not going to bump into them at the school gates. I mean, obviously these things happen very occasionally, but you're not going to have a relationship which is about anything else apart from that. And that's, I mean, that's why therapy works, because it's removed from everything else. And I think that's why psychosexual therapy, particularly if you're really worried about sex, it's kind of the clues in the name, the signs above the door. Like, we talk about sex here.
Yes, that's what we do. Exactly. It's like, you know, you can feel safe going into a fishmonger's if you want some salmon, but maybe not if you want, you know, a pair of shoes. The clues above the door, as you say.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Kate, for coming to talk to us. I mean, it's never not fascinating, is it, Emily? But I think it can also so easily flip from fascinating to frightening, self-flagellating and scary if you just end up in a strange place with this. But what we're saying is solution orientated. And I would highly recommend Kate's book, because there are an awful lot of solutions in there. The Science of Sex.
And lube.
Thank you.
I mean, I think you're right. Lube.
Just leave you with that thought. Lube.
Thank you so much, Kate.
You've been listening to Annabel Rifkin and Emily McMeekin of The Midult. Our book, I'm Absolutely Fine, is out now. If you like what you hear, please rate, review and subscribe.